This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
The Iowa Windfall. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
The primary caucuses in Iowa bring millions of dollars in revenue to the state. Here are the industries that benefit most from caucus capitalism.
The places in rural America known as education deserts, where higher education is more than a half hour drive away.
The restaurants that claim their menu items can help expectant mothers go into labor, like Prego Pizza at Skipolini's in the Bay Area.
And in a famous music city like Seattle, the hottest performances right now are in-house bands made up of employees from the likes of Amazon and Google.
The Google performances have become kind of a hot ticket in their own right. They're performed on campus, on the company patios or in company meeting rooms, and so you need to know someone who works at Google to get in. But they say they're still attracting hundreds of people to their performances.
Wall Street Journal reporter Chip Cutter on getting the work band back together. New York City-like hotel rates are finally subsiding in Des Moines, part of the financial windfall that Iowa enjoys every 4 years. As host of the first-in-the-nation presidential caucuses, the spending influx extends beyond hotel rooms, though, to things like political advertising, event production, office space, rental cars, restaurants, voter databases. John McCormick, national political reporter at the Wall Street Journal, had a front-row seat watching it unfold. John, what did you see?
This is a big economic boon for Des Moines, the capital city here in Iowa, but really statewide. I mean, brings tens of millions of dollars into the state. Probably, you know, one of the biggest things is advertising. So there's been more than $60 million spent in the past year in Iowa by the presidential candidates. But it also trickles down. So it's good for the hotel chains. It's good for restaurants. And it sort of trickles down to lots of different parts of the economy.
Goodness. And that is even after, within the last 4 years since the last primaries, Des Moines has added hotel rooms, right?
Yeah, I mean, this is not a small city. It's ranked 101st nationally in terms of population. The hospitality industry folks told me they've added 640 rooms since the last Iowa caucuses in 2016, but it's still not enough.
We're speaking with John McCormick, national political reporter for the Wall Street Journal. He's in Iowa. So we talked about hotel rooms. What about something like the price of a steak? Restaurants goose prices,
yeah,
a little bit too?
Fortunately, they don't raise the prices, and you can get lots of good restaurants in downtown Des Moines. But there is a place called 801 Chop House. It's sort of the premier expense account steakhouse in downtown Des Moines, where you'll see lots of media and politicians hanging out. They say it's the busiest time of the year. It's the busiest time every 4 years.
So with all the money that pours into a city like Des Moines during the caucuses, is the city able to use that as some sort of marketing platform or springboard to bring in more business, say, the other 3 years?
Well, they say all the free media attention that they get because of the caucuses are worth hundreds of millions of dollars if you were to buy that kind of coverage in the open market to advertise your city or your state. Obviously, they don't need to do that because they get a lot of free mentions on TV and in newspapers of, you know, Des Moines and Iowa. So it's very valuable for the city folks here, for they think from a marketing perspective. Obviously, you know, candidates seem like they also have, you know, people digging into their pockets a little bit deeper every caucus season. I've been covering the caucuses since 1999, 2000, when I was at the Des Moines Register, and this thing just grows and grows and grows. Every 4 years it gets bigger, and more people host these cattle call events, they call them, where all the candidates have to show up and, you know, speak for 15 minutes. It seemed like the number of those sort of events really exploded this cycle as well.
It's almost like was like a series of Black Friday events you made me think of. You referenced Elizabeth Warren's campaign, like popped into a local Subway restaurant and dropped like $1,200, I guess, for a bunch of staffers for lunch or something.
Well, I dug through some of the Federal Election Commission filings, and I suspect that was for some kind of event that she hosted with supporters. But there's spending both small and large. I mentioned the television advertising, which runs into the tens of millions of dollars. But you know, small things here or there. Elizabeth Warren bought $280 worth of state fair tickets because she had to go to the state fair and show up and bring some staff with her. So it's very good for business. It's one of the reasons Iowa and New Hampshire both fight so hard to keep their first and second status on the nomination calendar, because it's a real windfall for both of the states. Iowa, even to a greater extent than New Hampshire.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. Yeah. So if California were to somehow muscle its way to the top, it could really hurt Iowa, I guess, if it were to fall to, a third or fourth maybe on the caucus/primary list.
Yeah, well, California is going to be part of Super Tuesday on March 3rd, so they are near the front, but they're not at the very front. And, of course, one of the arguments that Iowa and New Hampshire make for themselves is that they're small. You can do retail politics here. Yes, you might have to buy some television advertising, but it's a lot cheaper than if you had to buy in Florida or California, a huge state with very expensive and many media markets. So that's been part of their argument for keeping their status as well, is that even if prices are tricking up, they still are a fairly affordable place for a politician to do business. And, somebody who doesn't have a lot of poll standing still can, work the state real hard and make a name for themselves.
Thanks, John. John McCormick, national political reporter at The Wall Street Journal. 12 minutes now after the hour. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Hundreds of American counties are known as education deserts, places that lack easy access to higher education within a half-hour drive. There are serious ripple effects because of that. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
It's a problem sweeping through rural America, a declining percentage of adults with college degrees. As David Jesse of the Detroit Free Press tells us, that lack of education is resulting in persistent poverty. David, what did you take a look at?
We looked at where community colleges and four-year colleges are located across the United States. And then in those areas, what household income do folks have? Are they rich? Are they poor? Are they middle class? And what we found was the places that lack easy access, we're talking about a 30-minute drive or so to some sort of higher education, really are those counties that are struggling with poverty.
And how many individuals are we talking about here across the country?
Somewhere around 5.4 million, 5.5 million live in some sort of an education desert. We're looking at, if you look at a map, if you think of a map of the United States, you're looking at some of the upper Midwest, across the plains, along the Rockies, and then in the deep South. Those are the areas that generally have these issues.
David, what is the role of a high school in these areas, and how can they convince students to pursue higher degrees or training?
The role of high school is really important. It starts, preparing them. It starts by giving them the mindset of talking to them about how important it is to get some sort of post-secondary education, post-high school education, and that could be everything from a certificate for a welding program or a nursing program, all the way to what we kind of think is traditional college degrees, a business school or something like that. And so there's a lot in these high schools. They're really, in these rural areas, they're really the core, the center of a town. And so we see programs that are getting into more and more trying to prepare students to do that college-level work. And some of it's just, convincing them that this is an important step, that the way out of the poverty they've grown up in or that their family is currently experiencing is some sort of further training.
We're speaking with David Jesse of the Detroit Free Press. David, could you, again, kind of lay out the vicious cycle that is in play here?
Well, the vicious cycle is kind of simple. You grow up in a small rural town. There's lots of poverty. Your family doesn't make very much money. There's no opportunity to get out of that town to get some skills training, some college education. So you can't get another job. And because there's no skills training, an employer, a manufacturing company, a computer software company, they don't necessarily want to locate in, some of these rural areas, which then, of course, keeps the lack of jobs down, which means if there's not jobs, there's not a chance to earn money, which means there's not a chance to pay for college, which means it's harder to go somewhere. And it just it's just this wheel that spins and spins and spins.
What are some of the solutions? How could a partnership perhaps help?
Well, there's a lot of places, community colleges that are trying to go into some of these high schools in communities like this and run programs. There's some places, we focused on one in Michigan called the Baldwin Promise that's paying a free college, you know, $5,000 towards tuition. You also see some employers who are starting to think about, you know, offering training of their own for people, contracting with a community college or another college, or even hiring trainers themselves. And so the key is how can you boost the opportunities and the skill level at the same time?
Are online classes an option?
They are for lots of folks, but then there's a significant number of these places where getting consistent internet access is very hard. You and I maybe don't think about that. I live in a big city. There's, you know, everywhere you go, there's hotspots and Wi-Fi, and it's not a big deal. But if you live out in the middle of rural Michigan, in the middle of rural Louisiana, you might have a hard time getting internet. And if you get internet, it's going to be super expensive.
That is David Jesse from the Detroit Free Press, part of the USA Today Network, with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. It is 20 minutes now after the hour. Thanks for being with us. There are more ways than ever, by the way, to connect to America's First News on the go. You can download our app. It's called This Morning with Gordon Deal. You can find it in the Apple or Google app stores. Also, you can tell Alexa, Google, or Siri to play This Morning with Gordon Deal. For more on all the ways to find our show at home, in the car, and on the run, you can visit the Find Us page at thismorningwithgordondeal.com. Though much has been made of young Americans' supposed reticence to cook for themselves, they nonetheless consume all kinds of information and entertainment about cooking. Amanda Mull, writer at The Atlantic, says even if you have no interest, you'll probably still recognize the tools that people flock to. Amanda set this up.
So what we did basically is I spend a lot of time on the internet as someone who is both in her 30s and writes about what people talk about on the internet. So I had noticed over the past several years that a lot of my friends, a lot of the people that I followed, were starting to do these sort of elaborate kitchen projects with very particular types of equipment. You would see these sort of big, heavy, enamel-covered, colorful pots or KitchenAid mixers, also very, very colorful, in the background of these, like, wonderful baking shots. And it just seemed like a thing that was really naturally attractive to me as someone who, you know, is getting a little bit older and has moved into her own place in Brooklyn and is looking for ways to make my home a little homier. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like people were having a lot of fun and doing it with these very, very specific tools and photographing it in these very specific ways. So I became curious about why that might be. And that's where the story came from.
Well, some of these things, too, that you reference, I mean, they have pretty hefty price tags.
Right. The sort of main thing here is that these tools, they usually cost between $100 and $500 or $600, depending on what you're looking at. So they're definitely pricey things, but they're the type of thing that somebody, you know, in their 30s, who lives by themselves and, you know, works in an office can, like, potentially afford if they save up a little bit. And they're sort of a nice alternative to renovating a kitchen or buying, a brand new, newly constructed house, which a lot of people in that age range in previous generations would be doing. But because of housing prices and stagnant wages and all of these things, a lot of people now who are in their late 20s, early 30s, just aren't doing those things. Hmm. So it's sort of a nice diversion from what our parents might have been doing.
Right. We're speaking with Amanda Mull, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's written a piece about how for many young Americans, stability and sophistication look like a KitchenAid mixer. So what has this meant for you? I'll put this in personal terms here. You've kind of become a soup junkie, right?
Yes. I bought my Dutch oven, which is like a beautiful sea blue color, looks great in photos. I bought this Dutch oven because I wanted to become a person who made soup. I didn't have any strong opinions about soup beforehand, okay. but it seems like a nice, you know, sort of goal to have. So I picked out a recipe. It's avgolimano, which is a Greek chicken soup. And I made it once, and it was like the most delicious thing ever. And it reheats great. Not only was it a nice process of making something that I can then enjoy, but it was also, you know, a really functional thing to have. I, you know, ate reheated soup every night. Soup reheats great. So I have made that soup in the past year, year and a half since I got this pot. I have made that soup probably 20, 30 times. And it's just, it's great. It's like a very meditative Sunday afternoon type project that has been really like a nice, pleasant thing in my life that I would not have anticipated it was otherwise.
That's funny. You referenced too in your story, the companies that make some of these tools that you reference, quote, have stumbled into a newfound appeal to people with more of a casual curiosity about cooking. But that, I mean, it seems like you're more than casual if you're laying out like, you know, $500 for some of these tools.
You would think so. but a lot of times people, I think, buy these things for the same reason that I did, which is because you want to be the type of person that uses these tools.
Okay.
The KitchenAid mixers, the Le Creuset Dutch ovens, are things that have been around for 100 years. Yeah. They're very traditional kitchen tools that that people got on wedding registries in previous generations and still do when they get married. So I think that the desire to have these things sort of, in a lot of cases, supersedes their actual utility.
Thanks, Amanda. Amanda Mull, writer at The Atlantic. Reminder, by the way, we can connect on social media. You can friend us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter, at This Morning Show. And you could follow me directly on Twitter as well, at Gordon Deal. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. When inspiration strikes, you should too. But how? What's the first step to bring your idea to life? Because finding the right freelancer for your business idea or project can be daunting. How can you find a quality freelancer you can afford? And how can you be sure they'll deliver? There's one easy answer to all of these questions: Fiverr. With Fiverr, you get more done with less. Fiverr connects you with freelancers who offer hundreds of services, from graphic design and copywriting to web programming, film editing, voiceover, and more. You can search by service, by deadline, by price, or reviews, and you can be confident to find quality talent you can count on at a price that's right for you. No negotiating necessary. Take five and check out Fiverr.com. That's Fiverr.com. Do it now and save 10% on your first order when you use my code Gordon. Fiverr, the fast, affordable way to bring your inspiration to life. Go to Fiverr.com and use the code Gordon to save 10%. That's Fiverr.com.
Now that Human Resources VP Ashley Campbell has Kronos for HR, payroll, talent, and time, she's managing her workforce like a rock star. She even has her own hype song.
I'm the spark before the fire. I'm the power in the train. I
have a really diverse workforce with different hours, skill sets, and pay grades.
Don't stop. I'm the dream and you should know that.
Now we're motivating and engaging the right people every step of the way.
Kronos, HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support them. Learn more at kronos.com/HR swagger.
Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, and growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. Dylan Miskowitz, COO of Cafe Altura, experienced how challenging hiring can be after unsuccessfully searching for a director of coffee for his organic coffee company. But then he switched to ZipRecruiter and saw an immediate difference. And you can too by signing up for free at ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. And its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates faster. In fact, after posting his job to ZipRecruiter, Dylan said he was amazed by how quickly great candidates were applying and found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon. That's ZipRecruiter.com/Gordon.
Catch America's first news online anytime at ThisMorningWithGordonDeal.com.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal, Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, coronavirus may be scary, but the flu is deadlier and more widespread. Also, spending business and family fortunes till they're gone. Plus, in-house music groups at places like Amazon and Google. And does a famous Bay Area pizza joint help induce labor? We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. The coronavirus has infected at least a dozen or so people in the U.S., but something more dangerous and much deadlier has been infecting millions of Americans, and that's the flu. Not only right now, but every year. More from Megan Henry, healthcare reporter at the Columbus Dispatch in Ohio. Megan, put this in perspective.
The coronavirus has infected 11 people in the United States, but compared to the flu, there are 19 million cases of the flu, hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations, and 10,000 deaths in the U.S. this season, including more than 60 children. So those are just some of the numbers here in the U.S. specifically.
Man, I would not have guessed that there have been 10,000 deaths this season from the flu.
Right. I was surprised as well, but it's shocking how widespread this is.
So how is it that, I don't know, we get so absorbed in what's new when it comes to a virus like this? Well, is that part of it because it is new?
Yeah, I think that's a lot of it, is that it's just this coronavirus is a new virus. It's unknown and it's foreign, originated in China, and so now it's coming. We're seeing it pop up in the U.S. and there's no known vaccine for it yet, and so people are kind of panicking because of those reasons.
Yeah. All right, so kind of in your neck of the woods there in Ohio, you've got, what are your numbers? You've got at least a few thousand, right, hospitalizations from the flu?
Yes. In Ohio, as of Friday, there have been 3,642 confirmed flu hospitalizations, and then at least one flu-related death of a child. And then the CDC reported that there have been about 30 flu-related deaths for people of all ages in Ohio.
You know, you talked to, I know, an expert in Ohio, and I thought he made an interesting point. And maybe that's why the 10,000 deaths were such a shock to me when I read your story. And that's, he said, the flu is something that people feel like they know.
Yeah, the flu has been around for a long time. It gets, every year people talk about getting their flu shots. But it becomes kind of like white noise in a sense, where the flu is something that people just know. It's more familiar. If someone gets the flu, that's, quarantine them or see it in the news as frequently as we do with a new virus such as the coronavirus. And so this is something that people are just familiar with.
We're speaking with Megan Henry, healthcare reporter at the Columbus Dispatch, part of the USA Today network. Her piece is called Coronavirus is Scary, but the Flu is Deadlier and More Widespread. And as you point out, too, we still really have a month to go, right, with the flu. The worst might not be behind us.
Yeah, the flu season peaks in December and February, and so the worst could still be yet to come when it comes to the flu.
All right, so what else should we keep in mind here as we try to put this in perspective?
I think, yes, the coronavirus is concerning, but unless you've traveled to China or you have contact with someone who is infected with the coronavirus, there really isn't much to be concerned about.
All right. And then what are the basics here in terms of trying to avoid the flu? Is it always about the shot?
Yeah, definitely. I encourage you to get your flu shot. If you haven't already, you can still get it. It's not too late. Really encourage just washing hands, covering cough and sneeze. And most importantly, I think, aside from getting the flu shot, is to stay home from work or school if you're sick. You don't want to spread it around to colleagues or other students. You just want to keep that to yourself, and it'll also help you get rid of it faster if you just stay home and rest.
Thanks, Megan. Megan Henry, healthcare reporter at the Columbus Dispatch in Ohio. By the way, in a bad year, influenza kills up to 61,000 Americans, according to the CDC. Thanks for spending time with us. Ever wonder how a family fortune from generations ago may have been squandered? Success often contains the seeds of its own destruction, whether it's a family fortune or a large corporation. We're joined now by Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's got lessons for today's big businesses based on the one-time fortunes of his great-great-grandfather, a tobacco man, whose fortunes would be worth more than $200 billion today if properly managed. Jonathan, explain.
There are really two problems with inherited wealth. One is the heirs didn't work for it. They didn't have the drive to create that fortune. And indeed, because they grow up in affluence, they often take money for granted. So between, you know, tendency to overspend because they take the money for granted and the fact that, you know, they're inclined not to work, you know, that's going to cause the fortune to start to dissipate. But on top of that, it's really hard to preserve a family fortune. And it's a little bit complicated, but essentially it comes down to this. You know, our standard of living rises every year along with per capita GDP. So as the economy gets bigger and everybody else grows more affluent and has a higher standard of living, we want that as well. So if you have a sum of money that you want to kick off income that grows with per capita GDP, you're going to need to reinvest that portion every year, an amount equal to that every year, after adjusting for taxes and after adjusting for investment costs. So if you do that, you reinvest that amount, that percentage equal to per capita GDP, it actually leaves very little to spend. So even on a huge fortune, the heirs are almost inevitably going to spend more than they should, and the fortune will slowly wind down. And it's really very common. A couple of generations and, you know, great family fortunes are gone. You know, the old comment about shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations, it's really true.
Yeah. We speak with Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. All right, so you also expanded this out to talk about today's businesses a little bit, and you said success often contains the seeds of its own destruction, and you referenced some of these companies that grow so large, like Google, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, which could be has-beens in, what'd you say, like a decade or two. How does this happen?
Well, we see this over and over again in the economy. We see these huge companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook, and we imagine, you know, these companies are going to be here forever. But that simply isn't the case. Great companies tend to lose their position in the pecking order for a number of reasons. One is because they're successful, they attract new competitors, and those new competitors tend to be more nimble, less bureaucratic. They're not hidebound to existing technology, and so they come along and they start to eat the lunch of these big companies. We have in the American economy and elsewhere in what's called gales of creative destruction. So it's not simply that a company like Amazon is going to face an upstart that does what it does marginally better. Some company's going to come along and do what Amazon does, but does it do it in a completely different way, and Amazon isn't simply going to lose its competitive edge. It's going to be blown out of the water, and we will see that with Amazon. We will see that with Facebook and Google and Apple, and all of these great companies will eventually fall from grace.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. So in Seattle, the city that birthed grunge, right, home to acts such as Pearl Jam, Heart, Nirvana, of course, the latest musical sensation is the Amazon Symphony Orchestra. Chip Cutter, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, says a new generation of company ensembles is getting the work band back together at places like Google and Salesforce. Chip, what's going on?
This is pretty fun. So across a number of different companies, we see employees coming together to launch new music groups, so, and particularly classical orchestras. So Amazon now has a roughly 100-person classical symphony. Google has one of roughly the same number. And Salesforce has launched an a cappella group recently called Cloudy with a Chance of Beatbox. And oftentimes we kind of see this kind of corporate ethos and music blur together.
Wow. So where do these folks perform?
They typically perform in company venues, so in corporate meeting rooms and at kind of corporate meeting sites. So Amazon's, for example, rehearses at the company's headquarters in Seattle. I attended one of the rehearsals. It takes place at 6:30 every Tuesday night, starts precisely on time, and it lasts for 2 hours. And then the group performs at the Amazon Meeting Center, which is a big meeting space the company has in Seattle. And typically these performances, which are often free to the public, can attract close to 1,000 people. So this has become a pretty big draw for these groups.
I mean, Amazon's, you said, is 100 people. That's... you don't just sign up, I would imagine. You got to have some skills, right?
You do. They say, the Amazon group says that they will take everyone, but this is a pretty serious orchestra. So it has a harpist, for example. It has multiple oboe players. It has a timpani. And its conductor is someone who majored in clarinet performance in college. She is someone who has performed with a lot of different groups, and she takes this really seriously.
How about that? We're speaking with Chip Cutter, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. He's got a fun story entitled, What Do Amazon, Google, and Salesforce Have in Common? In-house music groups. Are there YouTube performances that you can watch from these in-house music groups?
There are YouTube performances. Some audience members have uploaded clips to Instagram and shared their feedback there. What's interesting is that the Amazon performances are open to the public. Google's are not. And so the Google performances have become kind of a hot ticket in their own right. They're performed on campus, on the company patios or in company meeting rooms, and so you need to know someone who works at Google to get in. But they say they're still attracting hundreds of people to their performances. And then Salesforce, for example, performed at the company's big conference that's held every year in San Francisco called Dreamforce, and this attracts about 170,000 attendees. And so the beatboxers and the a cappella group were actually performing as part of that event.
I think there was one person who said it took years for him to get approved in one of these groups.
Well, that's right. That's at an orchestra. It's called the Texas Medical Center Orchestra. And this is a group made up of doctors and other healthcare professionals in Houston. Now, that group is led by a Juilliard School trained director. And the woodwind section has become so competitive that it does take years to get into it. One doctor was so dismayed and so frustrated that he didn't get approved right away that he actually emailed multiple executives at his hospital in frustration. And the director wasn't swayed. She said that she wants to get a group that really performs well together. And it's interesting, at that group and others, some musicians have had to leave rehearsals because work intervenes. And so doctors have had to leave to deliver babies and attend to patients. Coders at Amazon have had to run off from rehearsal because they were paged and there was some kind of technical issue somewhere. So sometimes you can't really kind of leave work aside, even if you're performing in some of these work orchestras.
How about that? Chip Cutter, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, can Prego pizza really induce labor? Let me tell you about my new favorite way to pass the time while commuting. It's the app called Blinkist. Blinkist works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books and whittles it down to just 15 minutes. Successful people like business leaders are well known for reading self-improvement books. I just finished listening to Snowball, a Warren Buffett biography. Listen to Blinkist while commuting or maybe exercising, even while you're waiting for your kids to finish practice. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read. I also like listening to some of the history titles since I never had much good history in school. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning to try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/morning to start your free 7-day trial. You'll also save 25%, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/morning. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save. Thanks for being with us. In an age when conflicting advice for everything related to pregnancy and childbirth abounds on the internet and beyond, many women in the San Francisco area and their families are turning to a local pizza shop to help deliver. It's called Schipollini's. The Wall Street Journal says when Abigail Hamilton visited last September at 39 weeks pregnant, she counted at least 6 other expectant women at the restaurant. Her waitress told her a trick: eat at least 2 slices of Prego pizza right away, take a walk, and then eat more. Contractions started the next morning, and she soon gave birth to her daughter. Medical professionals, of course, roll their eyes, but Schipollini's isn't the only restaurant to market to expectant moms. The Suburban, which is a sports bar in Excelsior, Minnesota, features a burger called the Labor Inducer, topped with Cajun remoulade, peach caramelized onion, and spicy Bavarian mustard. Eric's La Patisserie in Worcester, Massachusetts, offers labor-inducing cream cheese. The recipe is considered, quote, classified information. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.